Welcome to Innovation and Leadership. I'm Jess Larson. On this episode, I'm really excited to have Caroline Boudreau. Caroline, thanks for doing this.
So glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm so glad on the work you and your organization are doing in the world. Why don't you give people a little bit of an intro?
Okay. Well, I'm Caroline Boudreau. I am the founder of the Miracle Foundation, an organization that is dedicated to finding a loving family for every child in our lifetime. It's really about orphan children and foster children finding forever homes and how most of them have extended family. And so we work with children because we know that when you take care of children, communities do better, societies do better, countries do better when their children are taken care of. So that means less homelessness, less mental illness, less crime. And, you know, we know that in order to take care of a child, you have to take care of their family. And that's the work we do. It's awesome.
Yeah, you know, I feel like we need to start with a shout out to our mutual friend, Lindsay Hadley, for getting us introduced and all the things she's doing with Orphan Myth. And by the way, I had not seen that trailer for the Orphan Myth doc until that Sundance party we were at together. I was like on the back row, like hoping nobody saw me wiping my tears. Like, what a great program, Orphan Myth, and so glad that you guys can do stuff with it. For people who don't know much about it, can you explain this kind of meta campaign?
Yeah, yeah. The idea is that, you know, there are 5.4 million children living in orphanages worldwide. 80% of them have a living parent, and it's time for them to go home. It's time for them to go back to their families. And so we work with Orphan Myth. We work with a lot of different organizations. Countries all over the world have identified that orphanages are no place for children, and they're looking for ways so that we don't even need institutions anymore. And so the work that we do is, you know, like, so in the United States, we went from the orphanage system to the foster care system. Well, in the developing world, they're going from the orphanage system and they're leapfrogging over the foster care system, and they're going to a kinship model, an extended family model. Family care is what they call it. And it is working. And so that's the work of the Orphan Myth. Three myths in the Orphan Myth. Number one, that children that live in orphanages are actually orphans. They're not. Orphan number two, that there aren't orphans in the United States. There's about 100,000 children in the United States today that are ready to be adopted, that have been freed for adoption. And number three, that this is solvable. It like we just have to live with it. That's the myth is number three. So we just have to live with it. There's nothing we can do. And that is not a fact. The fact is we can solve this problem, and we are.
Well, you know, I think so many of our listeners are CEOs, investment fund managers, or people who want to become those things. And there's another part I want to bring up, which is the finances, that it's actually cheaper to support a family member, extended family member, one of those parents. It's actually less expensive to fund the parent than it is to fund the orphanage.
Five times cheaper to fund a family. And it is the epitome of sustainability. I mean, once you get a family strengthened so a kid can go back, you're done. If they're staying in the institution, you pay in every year, until they quote unquote age out. I mean, it's definitely a better financial model.
And like, that pales in comparison to the emotional toll of kids not being able to grow up with their families and not feeling a part of that love that as great as some of the orphanage programs are, and they're not all great, but as great as some of them are, you know, you look at the foster care system, you look at the orphanage system compared to family members who really love and care for them for the long term. And I mean, it's obviously so much more important than the financial aspect. And yet it takes money to get anything done. And so the idea that it would be like an 80% discount to fund the better model, it like appeals to my inner investor, right?
Yeah, lucky us, right? Lucky us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was so fun to talk about the idea of like how I feel like your work actually drastically reduces the need for our charity child rescue to exist. I mean, especially in the US, like holes in the foster care system that lead to youth homelessness I mean, that issue is so enwrapped in child trafficking, they're almost the same issue.
Yeah.
You know, statistically, a kid will be on a, like, kids on the streets within 48 hours will be approached by a trafficker. And like, there's such a emotional toll on the PTS and all the things for kids that even can get out of that system, or whether law enforcement or other aftercare facilities or people can help them get out. But again, back to the finances, the financial work to have a kid not get trafficked in the first place is like, you know, I don't know how to describe like how much more financially efficient it is. It's like a penny or a dollar.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And so I look at the work that you're doing and this idea of like kids not becoming homeless kids, which means they don't become trafficked kids, it is just like, again, my inner investor is like, what you guys are doing is like so wildly efficient, because not only does that kid not end up homeless and not end up trafficked, and not every homeless kid ends up getting trafficked, but they almost all get approached. Okay.
Yeah.
But the, like the love in the world that this kid who grew up with this truly loving family that cared about them, and what that kid can go do for others because they're not the one needing help. I mean, it's like a major multiplication effect, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I just think I love starting with the children. And, you know, so there's three things that need to happen and three things that we work on together with a lot of other organizations. You have to stabilize the children in the system, because there are children in the system today. So you can't just like quit funding altogether foster care systems and orphanage systems. You got to stabilize those children first. But then you need to reunify the children that are in the system. So that's a family strengthening program, whether that's foster care or orphan care. You got to do some family strengthening and reunify children with their families. And then the coolest and most important thing is to prevent children from ever entering the system. And so that's the work. So in the orphanage system, instead of a child going from a family that has a problem, because, you know, no kid is in the system because there's not a problem. There's always a problem. Let's face that. There's always a problem to fix. But you can fix a problem on the front end and with the child in the home and take care of that family with the child still in the home. Or you can do, you know, what a lot of people do is you remove the family, you move the child from the family, and then you start working. And it's really just a stupid, because once the child enters the system, the damage is done. So we need to be going from a child welfare system to a family support system. That is the idea. That is the goal.
Well, and, you know, some of the other people we've had on the show, you know, for those kids that aren't going to be able to go home, like there isn't a safe home for them to go to, the opportunities in adoption are incredible. We had the America's Kids Belong guys on.
Yeah.
And like, I've just been shocked by these like kids. They've got like something like less than 1% chance of getting adopted because of their age statistically. And then they'll get permission from the state to basically make a movie trailer of the kid. And it's like a 70% chance they get adopted within the first, I don't know, 12 or 24 months. And it's just like absurd numbers, right? Again, like videos that made me cry, right?
Yeah.
But you think about this, like the 80% that can go to, like you're looking internationally, right? Those 5.4 million children you talked about. Yeah. 80% that can go back to a home at an 80% discount to staying in the orphanage. And then the other, you know, 1. Whatever million that maybe there isn't a home to go back to, but, I'm so encouraged by some of the folks who have been turning orphanages into adoption centers.
Yes.
And helping these kids get a forever family. What a meaningful thing to be doing with your life, right?
It's so powerful. And, you know, getting orphanages to transform is really, we've just gotten better and better at it, because it's just so much easier to run a community center or run a community-based organization than it is to run an orphanage. So, these orphanages, they transform. People keep their jobs. They start helping. They become a community program. They become a feeding program. They become a school. They can become a computer lab for other people. And so a daycare. There's all these things that these orphanages can transform into that is really good for them. They keep their jobs. They can keep track of the children. And then, you know, the coolest thing that I've seen is the agency of the children. So, you know, we asked girls as young as 6 and boys as young as 8 who they want to go live with. And we talked to them about what does, you know, what's the difference between good touch versus bad touch and, you know, our bodies ourselves and, you know, talked to them about, we've given them some life skills education and they choose wisely. So they choose who they go home to and they are very, very good at choosing. And so then once the child identifies who they can go live with, then you go do a home study with that family, very much like an adoption, and you provide them with some of the support that you would have provided at the orphanage level. Like, I mean, that's where you get the 20% that it costs to take them into a home. And we've just been very, very successful in getting children out of the system and back into their families. It's just been remarkable.
And what countries have you operated in?
So we have mostly, our biggest footprint is in India. We started in India. And now we are in India, Uganda, Kenya, Tanzania, and in the United States. So we have taken this family strengthening program that we've developed so beautifully over these last few years, and we have brought it to the United States to strengthen families so that they never lose their children in the first place.
Yeah. Well, can you share a success story with us?
Oh, my gosh. Well, yeah. So I'll take Kalpana. So Kalpana was 6 years old when she went to the institution and to the orphanage. This is an example in India. She was 6 years old. Her dad died and her mother wasn't able to mentally, her mother mentally could not take care of her. And so she went into the institution. So we partnered with that orphanage. We asked the children with whom they could live with. Kalpana decided that she had an aunt that had come to visit her and really loved her. And so we talked to the aunt and the aunt said, look, you know, I would take her back in a minute, but I'm just really too poor. I can't afford her, you know, but I love her and I want her. And so we started off with a sewing machine. So we gave her a sewing machine. She learned how to make saris, like blouses for saris, like ready-made blouses for saris in a small village like she was in. That was an awesome thing. So she started making saris and started making a little money. And then we partnered with her, went 50-50 partnership with her to start like a convenience store. So it cost us about $1,000. She paid $500. We paid $500. We outfitted an entire convenience store right on the outside of her house. She never has to leave her house. And, you know, now she has a living and Kalpana went home to her. Now Kalpana is in nursing school. So, I mean, you know, and one, a beautiful spokesperson for us and just, you know, she's so grateful to have gotten a chance to go back because, you know, they all want to go home. Ask them. They all want to go home.
Yeah. Wow. What a great story. Okay. Now I have to hear another one.
Oh, okay. So Priya and her two sisters were sent to an institution they had a grandmother that came to see them all the time. And so when we partnered with that orphanage, we said, you know, we asked the kids, you know, who can you live with? She said her grandmother. We went to her grandmother's house, did a home study. Her grandmother had a pension. It wasn't a money issue. It was the fact that the grandmother thought she was too old to care for these kids. And so, and she also didn't have a school that she liked in the village. She didn't think the school was good enough for her children, for these girls to go home. So she said, look, if you will provide transportation, I will take the girls home. I just need them to go to a better school. And of course, that's, again, so much cheaper than paying for an orphanage. The three girls go home to their grandmother. And, you know, it's not just about the grandmother helping them, but now they can help their grandmother. You know, they can take care of her too. And so they have their chores. They're all there. It's a family now. And you know, just a beautiful story. And you know, when I asked them how they felt to, you know, I asked Priya how it felt to be home. And I mean, she just broke down in tears and she just said, I'm so grateful to be here. I just didn't belong. I didn't have a sense of belonging there. And that's what they're all after.
Oh, wow. By the way, what is the website if people want to donate?
It's called miraclefoundation.org. And, you know, the best way to support an organization. So, you know, it cost us about $1,260 to take care of one, to get one child out of an orphanage and into a family. It costs less than that, believe it or not, to prevent a kid from entering the system. But let's just take that $1,260. So the best way to help an organization like ours or any organization is to make a commitment. Do it every month, do it every year. Let us be able to budget because, you know, right now we honestly have you know, almost 1,000 children waiting for donations for them to go home.
Wow. That's great.
And if we knew that money was coming in, we could say yes to these kids right now. They're ready.
I want to talk about the idea of change. You know, on the show, we have these entrepreneurs or other people who are doing something that hasn't been done, that not everybody's ready to accept, and that the laws or the bureaucracies don't know how to handle, and they're always having to overcome all these hurdles. And I know so often it can be the same in the nonprofit world. Can you talk about innovation and changing minds?
Oh my gosh, it's such an important question. Thank you for asking. Yeah, so, you know, when I started this work, I used to be in television, and my best friend and I decided we were going to take a trip around the world for fun. And she wanted to go to India because she'd been sponsoring a little boy, and she wanted to go meet him, which, you know, I thought was a bunch of baloney. Like, Chris, oh my God, like, they give everybody the same picture. That kid is not real, you know? But we went to India. We ended up in a place called Odisha, which is on the eastern side, one state south of Calcutta. And we end up in this very remote village, and we get paraded through this village. And at the end of this parade is this little boy holding the first picture she'd ever sent. I mean, he was real, Jess. I couldn't believe it. And he was getting, you know, what the organization promised. And so we were doing volunteer work in that village every day. It was 119 degrees. I mean, it was just so bloody hot. Ooh. And we were going to, but the whole time I'm there, I'm thinking, wow, I mean, I'm so grateful to be, this is the bottom of the socioeconomic pyramid. I mean, this is who I've been reading about. I'm so grateful to be around these people. But I was so wrong. So Mother's Day was Mother's Day in the United States, May the 14th of 2000. I get up early, call my mom for Mother's Day, wish her happy Mother's Day, go to this village, work in 119 degree heat all day, and then go to this local's house for dinner and walk into his orphanage. And just the whole bottom fell out. I mean, I'm looking at these 110 bald, empty looking children, beautiful children. We have a beautiful prayer service with them. We have dinner with them, which is rice with sugar in it, so they'll eat it. And that's why they were bald. They didn't have any protein. And then this little girl came and put her head on my knee, and I picked her up, and I started singing her a lullaby that my mother used to sing to me because she was exhausted. And when you pick them up, they just push themselves into you. And I rocked her to sleep, and I sang her the lullaby, and she fell asleep in my arms. And when I went to put her in her room, I walked into her room with these wooden beds, like these 30 picnic tables. And when I heard those bones hit that bed, that changed me. I just have never really been the same person since then. I mean, I just thought, you know, who goes to an orphanage on Mother's Day, and what am I doing here? And, you know, why is it me that's here today? And I just decided that I would, you know, take responsibility. Responsibility, by the way, is the ability to respond. So I decided to take responsibility, and I started the Miracle Foundation that very day because they were such miracles, and I just saw the human potential in their, you know, in their eyes. And, you know, I just decided I was really going to try to help them. And so over the next few years, I started going into existing orphanages and supporting existing orphanages and improving the standards of care in orphanages. And we did that all over India. I mean, we were in hundreds of orphanages taking care of 15,000 children. And, you know, we started looking at the reports of the children, and we started seeing this thing called economic orphans, you know? So by the way, so we've got 15,000 children, we've got all these donors, we have a whole organization, and we start realizing that these children are actually not orphans. I mean, these children are called economic orphans, meaning their parents are just too poor to care for them. And that was my question, like, what does that mean, economic orphans? It means that their parents are too poor to care for them. And I thought, what have we done? You know, we have made it so more kids want to go into an orphanage rather than less. We've made it, it's like a pull factor. You know, it's like, oh, I'll never have a computer lab, but that orphanage has a computer lab, so let me send my child to the orphanage. You know, and we lost a real shift in our program, because we decided, you know what, we aren't going to support orphanages anymore. We are going to change, and we're going to make sure kids can get out. We're going to give them back to their families, and that's the work. And so that change has been very, it's been very kind of hard because we had to change our whole model, but easy because as long as you're working in the best interest of the child, you can do anything as long as you're working in the kid's best interest. But, you know, so the change and the pivoting is a necessary, you know, thing to do when you're running these kind of organizations. And so really it takes a vision. It takes someone that with some credibility to say, you know, I know that we were going that way, but now we're going this way. And, you know, change is inevitable. But, you know, as long as soon as you know better, you got to do better. And so, yeah, we've really had to transform our model, and we've done that. And now we are, I mean, one of the leading organizations in the world that are, you know, focusing on family care.
Such a great story and such courage to, you know, to say we haven't been doing this as good as we could and we're willing to take responsibility and change. How many years into the organization was that?
About 15. Yeah. And, you know, I want to thank you for asking because I wanted to tell that story because there are so many wonderful people that are giving to institutions. They are supporting orphanages. And there's a real belief that, you know, that's where innocence lives. And that's, you know, that's the place to support. But, you know, if you ask any child, they'll tell you that that's not where they want to be. The outcomes are a disaster, sometimes better than, you know, other outcomes. But if you're pouring that kind of money, you better have some darn good outcomes. You know, it's a lot. It's expensive to run an orphanage. And so I want to be, I don't want to be that poster child of the world that needs to look at family care as a different way, but I think I am, you know, like the person that learned how to do it differently. And that's what we need to do as a society. We need to learn how to, first of all, look at what's going on and say, look, there is a way to actually solve this. You know, as long as you're building a better mousetrap, you're never going to solve anything. So that's the other really exciting thing about this change is that it's solvable. I mean, boy, you know, ask Kalpana and ask Priya. It's solved. They're home.
Yeah. So when you think about like the good, better, best scenario, right? To me, it's like I compare it to kids being on the street.
Oh.
And, you know, our organization is so aware of what, you know, physical violence, sexual violence, all these things happens to kids on the street, right? And to me, like an orphanage is way better than that. Like orphanage calls gets to good, but then getting the kid adopted is better. Getting kids back with their own family to me is best. And I get that there's individual scenarios where that's not always the case, right? But as like a general rule, like this good, better, best of like, I think I love kind of the message from you guys of like, the institutions are not bad. They're so much better than kids being on the street. They're just so underdoing what's possible. And so, like, when the best is actually an 80% discount, why would we stick with the good?
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, we got to let go of what we thought at some point. You know, that's really the challenge. Because, I mean, I have people that come up to me every day saying, but the orphanage we support is really good. I mean, they are really doing it right. And, you know, I know that feeling. I've been there. But really, if you think about what's in the best interest of the child, and by the way, just ask the kid. They will tell you. We have kids that say, don't send me home. It is not safe for me. It is not safe for me. I had one young lady who had a birthmark on her face. She goes, please don't send me home. The only chance I have, I'll never get married. I'll never have children. The only chance I have is for an education. If I could just finish the education part and get, you know, if I could just please, you know, and so just talk to the children. They are, and when they have agency and they are part of the conversation, then they're also part of the solution. As opposed to what we're doing, you know, we're moving them all over the place. By the way, when a child moves, either from foster family to foster family, which we do an average of 7 times in this country, or they move from their family to an orphanage, or in, that is where the danger is. It's very dangerous when children move. That's when trafficking happens. And so if we could just keep them stabilized in one place, that's magic.
Yeah, no kidding. You know, something that is of interest, you know, never-ending interest to investment fund managers, to entrepreneurs, and to nonprofit leaders is fundraising. Right? The investment fund managers want an LP. The entrepreneurs want an investor or they want a fund. The nonprofit people want a donor. So how many years have you had the organization altogether now?
23 years.
23 years. When you think about lessons in fundraising, what are a few of the lessons you feel like you've learned that the rest of us could learn from the organizations that we might be helping in a nonprofit with?
Yeah. So, you know, in terms of raising the money, you know, it's a real challenge because I give this bridge example. You know, so if you're walking down the street and you see a baby drowning in the river, the only appropriate response is to jump in the river and save the baby. But what happens to nonprofits a lot of times is we see another baby in the river because now we're in the river. So now we see another baby in the river and we save that baby. We see another baby in the river and we save that baby. And we spend so much time saving the babies that we never look on the bridge and see who's throwing the babies into the river in the first place. And I think that is the challenge and the burden of nonprofits today, because donors love saving the baby. They love paying per child. Oh my gosh, that's so great. Let's just pay per child. But really, the truth is we at some point have to get up on the bridge and stop the children from entering the system. That is the challenge. And so it's a lot easier, I found it was easier to find people that would plug holes. You know, I mean, we talked to a lot of people and nothing wrong with it. It's just like, you know, backpacks for kids and foster care. It's like, really? I mean, when are we going to solve something? We can't just plug the pipes all the time. We have to, at some point, actually fix the problem. And so that's a harder conversation because people sure like the other one, but that's the conversation that I have. The other thing is, you know, you're dealing with a heart and a mind. And so, you know, you can pull on the heart all day, but unless you have some financial backing and really kind of show scale. Another burden of our generation is scale, because as long as there's a founder like me that's going to work every single day, 24/7, and think about it all the time, it can work. But what happens after that, which is where technology comes in, processes and procedures, you know, other people being able to take your model. So yes, I am a fundraiser at heart. I actually love to fundraise because I think people really want three things with their life. They want to love and be loved. They want their families to be happy, healthy, and taken care of. And they want to make a difference. And we offer that to people.
Yeah.
Why are you laughing?
Okay. Because I'm about to get some free consulting here. I'm gonna ask you to coach me. So you know, one of the programs we're working on, so our two big initiatives this year at Child Rescue is we're giving a Woman of the Year award to this woman who 19-year-old, she prevented 150 of her classmates from getting trafficked by the Taliban. And
amazing.
It's a super dramatic story. You can go, her name's Asma Pygir. I did a couple episodes with her. She's just incredible. And so we're giving her an award as a preventer, and we're raising money right now for her scholarship. She's going to Virginia Tech to study fintech. And we're trying to get CEOs who, you know, can pay, I don't know, even a couple $1,000 for a speech to have her come talk to their group about, you know, after being attacked and hit in the face with an AK-47 and basically threatened with her life, she risked it and got a hold of her sister in the military, and the Americans were able to force the Taliban to give the kids back. And, you know, and so, you know, trying to help her create like a public speaking career to help, you know, pay for her college and pay for her life. And now her parents have escaped from Afghanistan as well, and now they're over in the States as well. And they're starting life over. The Taliban stole all her stuff when she went into the airport. The only thing she was allowed to keep was her actual passport, you know, so she showed up here with literally zero, right? So, we're going to give her an award as a preventer and show that, like, hey, one person can make a huge difference, right? And try and get some scholarship money for her and some speaking gigs for her. And then the other one, on the prevention side is, law enforcement training. We've got some individuals from the intelligence community, who work very closely with law enforcement, and who basically are willing to teach an unclassified version of a course to American law enforcement on how to recruit a double agent in a gang. So you look at who's selling kids in America, MS-13, Hells Angels, Bloods and Crips in LA, you know, a lot of them are selling less drugs now and more children because they can sell them multiple times.
Oh,
and
God.
Yeah. And so getting those kids out is super important, right? But, when you do like a one and done sting, you know, when the cops do a one and done sting, like the kind of stuff that's on the news a lot, that's so meaningful to that one kid or young woman who they got out, right? But they didn't exactly like end trafficking in that city. It's like getting, like if it was drugs, that's like getting the equivalent of the street level dealer, right? But they're not getting the kingpins because they're not even trying, because they're A, not being asked to, and B, not given the training on how. So we are, our pilot program this year, we're putting money together for to have these, you know, FBI and CIA and DIA and Delta Force and all these guys do a 6-month coaching, like training plus 6 months of coaching to teach cops how to basically not be a cop, because they're not going to have a badge, they're not going to have a gun. They're going to go befriend somebody in the gang who, you know, there's some other stuff to it of like knowing who to recruit, but like they're going to befriend somebody just like, you know, a spy who's trying to figure out, you know, is this country trying to send a nuclear bomb to America, right? Like they be, it's not blackmail, like do this or I'll put you in jail. It's like befriend them to the point that somebody says, hey, I don't think it's good that our gang sells drugs, but it keeps me up at night. They're selling kids. I wish I could do something about this, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And that, at which point the officer's like, well, what if I could help you with that? You know? Right. I haven't told you everything about myself. There's a lot of uncopness. Okay. No badge, no gun, no force, no do this or I'll put you in jail. Do you know what I mean? It's a different skill set. So, but if they can not only, so this person who stays in the gang for 5-6 years, right, they're giving cops, you know, like bust after bust after bust after bust after bust, like the potential to like essentially defund this organization because they just keep getting caught over and over and over, right, becomes more plausible. And so the ability for that organization to hurt kids, I mean, A, get kids out, but B, reduce their ability to hurt kids in the first place and, you know, have them decide that this is not the business for them, you know?
Yeah.
So it's not something we can fundraise per kid. We don't know how many kids that operation, you know, we don't know how many people this cop will recruit after the cop gets this skill set. We don't know how many double agents he'll recruit over his lifetime. We don't know how many kids will get saved over their lifetime.
Yet.
But we feel like it's pretty reasonable representation that it's much less expensive to the system to have a kid not get trafficked in the first place, and B, from a humanitarian standpoint, much 100 times more important, right?
Right.
But this is not what law enforcement have traditionally been trained on. Like, there's very few spots in the FBI Academy, and you have to get a top secret clearance, and you have to have a month off work to go take the class. And, you know, there haven't historically been unclassified versions of the course. And so this is like, in hundreds and hundreds of years of police work, this is not a typical, like, you know, your homicide class, your
yeah.
B&E class. Like, this is a new class. Like, we're, you know, this is extremely well proven in the intelligence community for decades. It just hasn't been present except in like a few forms of law enforcement, like counterintelligence, right? And so, anyways, thinking about fundraising for something that hasn't been done before, that we can't fundraise per kid saved. Any expert hints?
Absolutely. I mean, cost per cop, you know, I mean, it's cost per cop, you know, sponsor a cop, you know, underwrite a cop, you know, I think it's awesome. People really like that one-on-one. They really, it really matters, especially if you can, you know, have, you know, you'd have to have a fake picture of that cop. I mean, you'd have to protect him, but as long as, you know, just make it real, you know?
That's such a good idea. Maybe we could like let them choose their own code names, you know, like you'd be Maverick and Iceman. Because it probably is like, it's like only about $3,000 per officer for the full 6-month program.
I mean, come on. There you go. Yeah. Cost per cop. I mean, I'm telling you, it's, you know, and then they get to, then, you know, of course you're going to have metrics. You got to take care of your metrics. You got to, you know, count. And then, you know, it's a pilot program. It's seed funding. So, you know, some people really love that initial, oh my God, you know, we were at Miracle Foundation, we're fortunate because we knew we were going to lose a lot of donors. We lost a lot of donors. We lost a lot of a couple board members. I mean, it was a costly thing to do to transform our model and our methodology. And we had a seed funder that came in alongside us and just said, I will cover you for a couple of years. I know it's a hard thing to do. And, you know, this catalyst funding, the seed funding, if you will. Because we didn't have any proof that it would work.
Yeah, that's great. You know, okay. When I change the website homepage of childrescueassociation.org, I'm going to send it to you. You can tell me if I did it right.
I'd love that. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. But yeah, it's a good point. Because, I mean, I probably only need we only need like 10 cops for the first pilot program. Like it's probably only, it's only like 30 grand for the first pilot program, but I should break it up per cop, huh?
Well, it depends on who you're talking to, you know, but yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, maybe you ask somebody to do five cops.
Yeah.
Well, another person to do okay. five cops, you know, but yeah. And then you have this nice, you know, I like it that you have these nice tangible numbers, you know, you need 30 cops. Great. Is that what you said? How many cops do you need?
10 cops.
10 cops. Yeah, 10 cops. Absolutely.
Okay. Okay. I'm going to do it. I want to go, let's go back. I want to hear another Miracle Foundation story.
Oh, let me see here. There are so many. You know, one of the things that, you know, we talk about stabilizing children in the system. You know, so one of the things that we do is we work with case managers and social workers in the United States and give them tools and training and, you know, basically an app. And, you know, when a case manager is supported, one of the things we've learned is that people in the system, they hear, you know, say when you talk to a foster family or you talk to a case manager, all they hear about is how bad the programs are, you know, because when somebody gets struck by lightning, that's when the news comes up. I mean, you don't ever hear about the millions of people every single day that don't get struck by lightning. You only hear about the one guy that gets struck by lightning. And so that's what's happening in the foster system today. It's like, you know, there's every day there are people, real people, fighting the good fight, raising children, taking care of children, trying to prevent children from entering the system. I mean, just really doing beautiful work. And when you find out somebody's a foster parent or a case manager, all we do is talk about how bad everything is. And so, you know, we really love to see the attaboys. That was one of the things that's missing in the system, or the attaboys. Like, thank you for doing that. And so, you know, there's so many things that we can do, but like changing our narrative around things is really like a powerful thing. You know, changing our narrative around the fact that, you know, yes, the foster care system needs help. Yes, it's broken. And we're on our way to do something about it. And we're not going to stand for this. We're going to keep going. And so I think, you know, the narrative and the stories that we tell ourselves around things are really, really important. Like I tell my story every day. I tell myself every day how grateful I am that I get to do this work and really make a difference with my life. I'm so grateful that, you know, that I get to live a committed life and do something for other people. And so I just think that, you know, that's really the story. You know, one of the success stories is the stories of the donors and the stories of the people that really get to make a difference with their life. It's really beautiful. People feel so good about taking a stand for somebody else.
Yeah.
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 You know, I really ask your listeners, you know, are they taking a stand? You know, are they on purpose taking a stand for someone or something? You know, I mean, and that's really what I see is just missing today is that, you know, I'm working on something called the Nemo Collective, and the Nemo Collective is all about, you know, there's a story in Finding Nemo where all the fish get caught in the net and they're all struggling to survive. And I think about all these, you know, all these nonprofits, they're all struggling to survive and they're in this net. It's like, oh my God, we're going to die. Oh my God. You know, and Nemo swims in the middle of the net and he says, swim down. And they all swim down and they ultimately break the net. And really what's really missing, what the missing piece is people, like-minded actors acting. It's the only thing that has ever changed anything is like-minded actors acting. And so, you know, I'd love your listeners to really think about, you know, are they on purpose doing something every day? I mean, if we thought about our health the way we think about our philanthropy, we would all be about dead. You know, like, you know, we really need to be thinking about our philanthropy the way we think about our health, which is probably every day.
Yeah. Yeah. No kidding. Okay. So we've talked about India. We talked about America. Tell us one of your stories in Uganda or somewhere else.
Yeah. Uganda's interesting because Uganda, you know, they had a lot of kids that were in institutions because of disability or HIV. I mean, obviously that's around the world. And what we've seen in those countries is that, you know, where, you know, you try to find families for children and a lot of times they don't have families because their families died of AIDS, you know, back in the day or, you know, recently. And so one of the things we've done is, you know, we've asked the kids who they want to live with. And a lot of times they want to live with the kid in the institution, their family. And so we've seen other people like take, okay, I'll take my child back and I'll take their best friend because his best friend doesn't have a family. And we've seen that several times there. And, you know, another one was, you know, people that will take a child with a disability. And, you know, there's this kind of stigma and, you know, you ask the mom, you ask the woman that took the child with a disability that was not her child, you know, an adoption. Well, how did other people in the neighborhood feel about you taking this child that was a disability? And she goes, oh my gosh, we got six kids in this neighborhood now with disabilities. We all took one, you know, they love it. It's just like this really inspiring thing. And so, you know, it's not really the wealthy that are making the powerful difference. It's just the average bear is making huge differences all over. And it's just so beautiful to see. So beautiful to see. People really genuinely care about children. And so it's been humbling. And, you know, we worked for kids so long. No kid should be grateful. No kid is really grateful. But these moms, these single moms, it's like I said, it's a fight against poverty. They're so grateful to have their children back. You know, it's just way too expensive of a price to lose your child because you're poor. So when we get those children back to those moms, they're just so grateful. It's beautiful.
I love so much the story with the sewing machine and the business and like the inherent like self-funding that now happens.
You know, the first rung to the ladder of success is 10 feet tall. So if you could just get them on that first rung, that, you know, that's where the magic happens is in the, you just get them to that first rung and then they climb, you know, they climb. And you know, it's not like they're running that business by themselves. Their kids are part of it. Their kids are part of that convenience store. Yeah, they call it a petty store. You know, so we do petty stores. I mean, at least once a week, we buy somebody a petty store. At least once a week.
That's so great.
Yeah.
Okay, let's give everyone the website one more time.
It's miraclefoundation.org. So the kids are the miracle and we are the foundation.
I love it.
Yeah.
What's something you want to leave people with today?
Just thank them for listening, for sure. Thank you all for listening. I appreciate it. Taking the time out of your day to listen to something important. And if it calls you, take a stand with us and let's solve this problem. And, you know, if we can get together, if we can all fly in the same formation, if we can all swim down at the same time and do it for a few years, then we can really break the net and everybody can swim free and we can really help a lot of people. And then if you can do it in this space and you can do it in the trafficking space and you can do it in the water space and we can do it in the education space, you know, we all need to start forming collectives and focus.
That's a great message. I'm glad that's what you chose. Listen, this has been so much fun. Thanks for making time to do this.
Oh, thank you, Jess. I really, really appreciate the time and the energy and the recognition of this really great work. And then, of course, you know, the documentary is coming out, which is so exciting. And I'm glad you got to see the trailer. It's a really good documentary. And it's all about this work.
And actually, if people want to find out, like, do they already have a website up for the Orphan Myth documentary, or should they just Google it? How do they find out timing on that?
There is a website for the orphanmyth.org. It'll
probably be on there.
Yeah, I do think it's on there. Yeah, and okay. They should find out. But it's in trailer. You know, we were at Sundance. It's the trailer's out, and it's going to be great because it's a real story of hope. It's a real story of a transformation. It's awesome.
Yeah, no kidding.
I hope. Okay. Were you inspired by it? Did you love it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was like pretending I wasn't crying on the back row. Like pretending I wasn't like tearing up. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so full of hope. It's just great. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so good.
Really grateful to be
Thanks here. For listening. Yeah. Bye, everyone.